there. Come on in. It's time for Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is we don't talk about Write Club, but for you, we're breaking the rule.
Well, welcome everyone to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm with Pat.
Hi.
I'm with Linda.
Hello.
I'm with Teresa.
Hi.
And I'm with Stephanie.
Hello there.
Today, Teresa's going to be naming the novel. Linda's going to be reading from her work in progress. Teresa's going to be telling us about an interesting word. And then we've got an interview with Tom Bromley, all about editing and the role of the editor. And finally,
Pat's going to tell us what's on her bedside table. But now, name the novel.
Over to you, Teresa.
Okay. Everybody ready with a pen and a piece of paper to name the novel?
Yeah.
Clue number one. The first sentence of this book is, happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way.
I know that first line.
Yeah, I know the first line.
Okay, would you like another clue?
Yes, please.
This classic 19th century novel has been filmed over a dozen times since the first Russian adaptation in 1911.
Okay, I think so.
Well, hopefully clue three will give it to you. The eponymous heroine leaves her husband and child when she falls passionately in love with Count Vronsky.
I've got it.
Yay!
She's got one.
Yeah.
Linda, have you got it?
I think so.
Okay. Anybody else got it?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think
just
so.
Just Stephanie.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Go on then. Tell us what it is, Nicola.
Anna Karenina.
Bravo.
Yes, that's
what I've never read it, but it was right. The word eponymous.
That's what got me.
Because I thought it was War and Peace.
The Russian thing was a clue as well. Good clue.
So, yeah, the answer is, of course, Tolstoy's Anna Karenina.
And so eponymous. Eponymous means the
self-named.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Right.
Jane Eyre.
So who?
Eponymous.
I got
these two got
one.
It on clue.
After clue one.
Three.
No.
Clue three. Nicola got it after clue three.
I got it after clue. Was it clue three, the eponymous?
Yes.
Yeah.
And
me.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, I don't think you're challenging me, girls.
No. So the scores on the doors now are Teresa 6.
I'm going to get something.
Sorry, Teresa 11, Pat 6, Nicola 1, Linda 1.
No, I must have more than one because I had one before and now
I've got
another
one.
I think we should pass on the scorekeeping.
The scores are Teresa 11, Pat 6, Steph 4, Nicola 2, Linda 1.
Yay, Linda!
I'm on the board.
Off and away.
Yeah. But let's take away that duty from Steph because she seems to always get them wrong, the scores.
Very happy to pass it over to whoever wants to.
As Steph does 99% of the organising,
I think she does.
We can give that job to someone else.
Okay.
But so nobody's read it, did you say, or anybody's read it?
No, I've read it.
You've read it?
Yes.
Good. Did you know, Linda, that one of Tolstoy's motivations to write the novel was to illustrate the evil influence of sex?
Oh. No, I did not.
He was very much in touch with the Shakers because he shared their belief that all sex, even within marriage, is evil, which is quite ironic. His strongest anti-sex novel, The Kreutzer Sonata, was written when Tolstoy was in his 70s, but it caused great humiliation to his much younger wife, Sonia, who was pregnant at the time of its publication.
Thereby giving the lie to
his theory, you know, but the flesh is weak. Anybody into Russian literature?
I went through a phase of Russian literature.
Yeah.
Brothers Karamazov.
Oh, yeah.
Crime and Punishment.
I did write an essay on Lenin. For my history O level.
Or do you all prefer the TV adaptations?
I prefer the TV adaptations.
I remember the costumes were gorgeous, but I didn't watch all of it.
There was a good War and Peace last year, wasn't there?
Now, Linda's going to read from her work in progress, and I'm looking forward to seeing what's happening to our favourite heroine this week.
Little Mary Magdalene. or Mary Magdalene, as we say in the South. You know, I've been reading excerpts out of order, not in any sort of chronological order. I think I'm starting to feel like now, for example, I'm going to read something that I've written recently, and it would takes place nearer the beginning of the book. And I find that in this segment, I have changed some of the characteristics of the father character. Oh, okay. So I'm not sure if he's going to be nice or bad.
Is he evolving or devolving?
I think he's evolving, actually, but I'm going to have to go back through what I've written and change some of the things there. And I really would like to hear from someone, maybe our listeners would say, about what audience this is for, because I started writing it as something I thought would be for an adult novel, but this is, the heroine is this little girl who's 10 and 11 through the story, and it seems to me when I'm going through it now, it seems to me it's reading like a young adult or something, but I don't want it to be a young adult.
I think it's fine for an adult audience. Mm. And if you think about something like To Kill a Mockingbird, where the protagonists
true.
Are young, and it is a book that people read in school when they're 15, 16, but it's an adult book that
that's
you can
true.
Read it.
You're very yeah. right.
I'm
that's
really
a good thing.
Wholeheartedly.
Thank
yeah.
you. Okay. So
and it just put me in the mind of
and the Mill on the Floss is about growing up. And,
I haven't read that. Well, okay, today we're, as I said, much nearer the what will eventually be the beginning of the book. And you'll remember this is set in the South in America in the mid-1950s. Mama just got sicker and sicker. Dr. Rainey came and went, but finally shook his head and said there was nothing else he could do. Eli started talking to preachers who claimed if they laid on hands and prayed, God would heal her. Mary Magdalene knew that Mama didn't believe in that kind of stuff, but when Eli brought them to the house, she smiled and let them lay their hands on her forehead and command God to heal her. When the first one didn't get results, he brought home another one. Mama never complained, even when their prayers went on longer than they had a right to. It really got on Mary Magdalene's nerves. She thought if they didn't have enough pull with God to make it happen, then they had no business claiming they did. She had seen Eli praying, too, his thick brown hair falling over his bowed head. Mama had always said Eli looked exactly like Montgomery Clift. Mary Magdalene didn't know what Montgomery Clift looked like, but she figured he had to have been handsome. She had a picture in a frame of Eli and her mama before she got sick, where Eli stood behind her with both arms around her neck, and they were laughing at something Mary Magdalene couldn't see. She treasured that picture, especially after Mama got sick. Despite her misgivings, she prayed too, alone and in silence, with hands folded and eyes closed. Surely, she reasoned, God would not ignore the prayers of a little girl who asked nicely and sincerely for her Mama to get well. But Mama died anyway, and Mary Magdalene had not been on speaking terms with God since. Near the end, Mama had told Eli that he might should take Mary Magdalene and move to Little Rock so her sister, Faynelle, could help raise her. And Mary Magdalene had heard Eli promise that he would. At the funeral, Mary Magdalene had sat between Aunt Faynelle and Eli, feeling sadder than she ever had in her life. But whenever she sniffled, Aunt Faynelle's perfume tickled her nostrils. It smelled like flowers and oak trees and earth all at the same time. Whatever it was, it made a good impression. Aunt Faynelle was beautiful. She wore a small black hat with a little net that hung down partway over her face. Her hair was the same shade of red that Mama's was, but where Mama had always kept her hair short, Aunt Faynelle's was long and pulled to one side, with a wave falling across her forehead on the other side. At the graveside, Aunt Faynelle put on sunglasses and looked exactly like a movie star. Eli made pitiful little sounds that hurt Mary Magdalene to the quick. She knew he was trying not to bust out crying, so she kept her head down and concentrated on Aunt Faynelle's strappy high heels that were slowly sinking into the red clay mud. When the burying was over with, the neighbor women came up, one by one, to hug her and bless her little heart, while their husband sidled over to shake Eli's hand and mutter words that nobody could make out. The women mostly just nodded at Aunt Faynelle. After everybody had left and all the flower arrangements had been laid on the grave, the three of them stood there for a while in silence. Eli held on to her right hand, and Aunt Faynelle held on to her left hand, and they inched away from each other until she was stretched out between them like Jesus on the cross. Aunt Faynelle asked Eli how long it would take for them to get to Little Rock. Eli answered that they would come after he sold the house and swapped for a better car. They sounded cross, like they were quarreling, but Mary Magdalene put that down to them being so sad. She knew that she certainly felt thrown off by having to watch her mama be buried, and she reasoned that they probably did too. "You've got my address," Aunt Faynelle said to Eli. "You ride along the way and let me know where you are so I'll know when to expect you." She bent to give Mary Magdalene a hug, then turned to go. "Do you think you could do that, Eli?" "I might could. I'll see about it." Aunt Faynelle let go of Mary Magdalene's hand and started toward the road, her high heels making soft sucking sounds with every step. Eli was still holding on to her, his grip so strong now it hurt, but she did not ask to be released.
Wow. I mean, it's really subtle and touching piece of writing.
Mm.
Mary Magdalene, or you know, everything she's going through, but she still has this antenna for other people's feelings.
Yeah, her empathy is quite astonishing.
Mm. I love the way the tragedy and sadness is underplayed, actually. I find it very hard to find anything negative to say.
Absolutely.
You know, the subtle way you understand that the other women don't approve of Aunt Faynelle.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
it's so subtle, but it's there. You know, they don't take any notes of her. They're not, you know, and she has this glamour, this out of town, and so, you know, is she some kind of scarlet woman in their eyes or what? But it's just very good, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree. I can't really find anything about it to suggest that you might look at it. I think it's amazing. I love, surely she reasoned God would not ignore the prayers.
Yeah.
And then the next paragraph, so Mary Magdalene had never been on speaking terms with him since.
Again, this, she's this intelligent, rational person.
Yeah, he's let her down so badly.
Yeah.
And the photograph that she's going to treasure for the rest of her life.
Mm.
You know, the picture of them when they were happy. Oh, it's just heart-wrenching. You really feel the tragedy of the whole thing, and it's because you've done it so subtly.
Oh, thank you.
Not rubbed our noses in it. Let us feel it rather than tell us what to feel, which I always love in writing.
I was a little concerned that it might not be, might not have enough gravity to it.
No, I think it's less is more in this
passage.
Yeah. Very much.
I picked out that same passage that Steph just mentioned. I've got not ignoring the prayers of a little girl who asked nicely and sincerely. And that, to me, was kind of brought you back to the fact that she is a little girl.
Yeah, she's a child.
You know, she's so mature in so many ways, but that idea that, you know, if I'm really, really good, I do this really, ask really nicely, that it'll happen.
Yeah.
And held between them like Jesus on the cross.
That's lovely. The thing that really moved me was... and I haven't found a particularly sympathetic character in some of the stuff we've read so far, because, as you say, perhaps his character's changed as you've gone back. But, you know, the noises, the pain, the noises and pain he was making.
Yeah.
I have a word suggestion for you, you know, take it or leave it. When you said something about cutting to the quick, was it struck to the quick?
When it says she...
I was expecting...
It hurt her.
No, it's when you're talking about Eli... And it says something along the lines of struck at his core. I was expecting to say core there rather than quick.
I said, no, Eli made pitiful little sounds that hurt Mary Magdalene to the quick.
Yeah, I was expecting you to say to the core there.
No.
So I'm not suggesting
to the core is more of a cliche.
I'm not saying change it. It was just especially as it came straight after the bit that I felt, you know, was very... poignant indeed. Thought that he couldn't contain his pain and he was making those noises.
Yeah.
I suddenly felt sympathy for him.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't up until now.
Good.
I liked your description of Aunt Fennell's perfume.
Yes, so did I. I was wondering what it was.
Yeah.
I think it's got
to
be...
Did you have a perfume in mind?
Well, doing research online, and I wanted her to have something that would be sensual, because I think Aunt Fennell is kind of a sensual woman. So I was looking at it. I was looking at how that fell in the mud. Remember when you used to stand on soft ground?
Yeah,
yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and then they make the sucking sounds
as
they come out.
There's one called Poison, isn't there? Which
yeah.
Is, which,
but you've got to get,
that's
yeah, you've got to get the period right.
Yeah, that's not it. The one that... The one that was really popular in the 1950s, that was, I can't remember the name of it now, R-O-C-H-E was on the end of it.
John Rocha.
No, R-O-C-H-E's.
Yeah, so.
Before you were born, Nicola.
Oh. I remember Nuit d'Amour.
Only just.
Was it Nuit d'Amour? I don't know. My mum always had Bluegrass or Chanel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just trying to find, and Musk came up a lot, but it has such an earthy smell, and
I
thought that's part of that insult.
Woolworths in the 50s, because they had.
They did.
I don't remember Woolworths in the 50s.
Well, bless your heart.
And they,
well,
they had two different perfumes. One was in a little blue.
Evening in Paris.
Evening in Paris.
Yes.
Soir de Paris. And then there was one in red.
You can't see it, but Teresa and Steph are just giggling and giggling to each other, like, because they're younger than we.
Yeah.
They have fewer years, in fact.
No, they're less old than we are.
Very good. Do you ever find feel that people are teasing you, like the Mickey, your pedantry?
I think it's all
so.
I think it's
I think they're just trying to please Tinkering.
Oh, that's that's absolutely right.
Trying to rival you in the girly swap.
Yes, right.
Anyway, I must get a grip, because it's usually me complaining about the chairman not having a control of these proceedings. So we're on to Teresa now, who's going to tell us about her word of the week.
Thank you. My word of the week this week is bimbo. Now, this came up some weeks ago when I was talking about akimbo, and I mentioned it as a rhyming word. One of the members of our Write Club the Podcast Facebook group, Bob Barrow, pointed out that this is a word men use to denigrate women.
Bimbo.
Quoting the definition, an attractive but empty-headed young woman, especially one perceived as a willing sex object. Now, he's absolutely right, of course, but at the back of my mind, I had the idea that this originally, the word bimbo, referred to a man, probably something I heard, you know, the godhead Susie Dent mention, but that was in the back of my mind anyway. So I had a look online, and I found the first reference to be around 1919 from the Italian Bambino. And it was first recorded in the Italian theatre in the US and used to mean a stupid, inconsequential man or a contemptible person.
Ah, oh, right.
A bimbo boy.
Wow. we'll add that to the list. Okay. P.G. Woodhouse was very fond of the word, apparently. So the OED cites him using it in his 1924 book, Bill the Conqueror, quote, "The bimbo pike arrived." And again in 1947, in Full Moon, he refers to bimbos who went about the place making passes at innocent girls after discarding their wives. So as far as P.G. Woodhouse was concerned, even as late as 1947, he was using it to refer to men. However, the sense floozy was already current by 1920, so this is a word that came into the language around 1919, but had already transferred to a female sense. And again, the OED cites the 1937 publication Detective Fiction Weekly. "We found Durkin and Frenchy Lasseur seated at a table with a pair of blonde bimbos beside them." And this word sort of faded away a bit, and it came back into use in the 1980s, apparently in the wake of various US political scandals. And in 1990, we got the diminutive bimbette. 1988, it became a male version, became himbo.
Okay.
But I think we have to add Stephanie's coinage, bimboy.
Yes, bimboy.
Oh,
in the dictionary.
Next thing, I'll be American. Right. Oh. Other words.
Get your green card for that.
Oh, thank you, Teresa. That was fascinating. and a little difficult to follow.
Is that because you're a...
Yes, perhaps I think I'm turning into one as my advancing years progress. Now we're going to hear from Tom Bromley. And Steph, as a means of introduction, would you like to tell us a bit about Tom and how you met him?
I met our next guest when he was the tutor to my class at a Faber Academy writing a novel course. He's also a director of fiction at the Professional Writing Academy, published author both under his own name and as Thomas Black, host of the Salisbury Writing Circle, a columnist with the Salisbury Journal, founder director of the Salisbury Literary Festival, and he's a ghost writer, that is. And along with all that, he works as an editorial consultant and mentor for a number of publishers and literary agents. He is Tom Bromley. Welcome, Tom. Very glad you could join us and fit us in with all that going on.
Thanks for having me. I feel quite tired just listening to that list.
And so you should. Now, among your long list of writerly pursuits that I've just been through, you are an editor, and that's really what we'd like to talk to you about today. So how did you get to be an editor?
So I worked as a commissioning editor in London for about, I think, 7 or 8 years in total. I suppose, I mean, my first job in publishing, I worked as a copywriter for Little Brown. And so it was a really nice job. I used to go in, I used to write all the blurbs on the back of the books. It was a lovely job. I'd go in, you know, you'd start in the morning, you'd read a manuscript and then write the blurb in the afternoon. And so I think through that, I would go to sort of editorial meetings. I remember doing some editorial work for an agent I got recommended to do by one of the editors. And then an opening came up. One of the main commissioning editors at the publisher left, and he did so much commissioning that they sort of divided his role. Commissioning in terms of a lot of different kind of nonfiction kind of stuff, but that's how I started. It was quite an unusual route. I think normally you would join as an editorial assistant and then you become a copy editor and then become a commissioning editor. And I seem to sort of jump that process a bit because I'd been around and kind of knew a bit already.
Yeah. So, what special skills do you think it takes to be an editor or to be a good editor?
Patience, I would say. Probably dealing with people. I mean, I think I'd separate editors out into, I mean, there's two categories, I would say. So with a sort of publishing hat on, there's what's called commissioning editors, who are the people who acquire, who buy the books and become the, I suppose, almost like the project managers of kind of seeing that kind of book through to production. And that kind of editor will do what's known as kind of structural editing, where you're doing the kind of bigger picture kind of stuff. And then there's a sort of another type of editor who's the kind of copy editor or line editor, who will then be doing more of the kind of line by line edits of the book. It's unusual for the same editor to do all of that. You'll get one or the other. And so I think those skills require different things. If you're commissioning books, I think it's having a sense of the market, having an idea of what you think might sell. It's about being passionate about your project so you can persuade the salespeople to take it on and take a punt on these different books. I think when you're doing the structural editing, I mean, because I was a writer as well, I think I found that easier, or I had more of a sense of it, to understand about, you know, story and kind of narrative and shape and work out, you know, how to mould what is already there. I mean, quite often you will get a book at that situation that's a good book, but you know, how can you make that better? I think that's the skill you kind of need there. Mm-hmm. And then if you're a copy editor, it's about that real eye for detail. You know, it's that line by line kind of focus. I mean, a lot of the editing I do are, these days I do some fiction, but it tends to be on subjects I know kind of bits about. So I do editing of cycling and football books, for example, and those tend to come to me because I know a bit about cycling and football, so I can check the facts, or know where to look for the facts, or know the facts already. So they tend to kind of match up an editor with what you're writing. So if you're writing a historical novel, you'll tend to work with someone who's used to working on kind of historical fiction, and that kind of stuff.
Okay, so for us as writers, so I've got a novel that's nearly finished it's always going to be nearly finished. It's never going to be finished. But so I'm starting editing. So what do you think are the things that I should look for? What would be your top tips to me when I start on that process?
I think, I mean, the first thing I would say is you should approach the editing with a kind of creative hat on. I think sometimes when people write, it feels like that initial process of the writing is the fun bit, and then the editing is kind of hard work or a bit of a slog. But I think editing, when done properly, is actually a really creative part of the process, because you're thinking about your ideas, you're working out, you know, different ways that you can get those out as clearly as possible for the reader. And so for me, I think the key thing with editing, you need to get that whole draft down, because you need to see the script as a whole. I'd always resist the temptation to kind of edit as you go along. And once you've got that full draft there, for me, I have to do that on paper. So I need to print it out. I think it always feels different on the page than on the screen. You know, get your, you know, green pen, red pen, blue pen, whatever you use, and kind of scribble all over it. And then go back through. And I think the key thing for me with editing, it's about bringing those ideas out, and it's about pace. So I sometimes describe it as a sort of concertina process. So there'll be bits in the book when you go back through that need expanding, so you can really kind of bring out the kind of maximum drama in a scene. And there'll be bits as well where you need to kind of condense it down, because there's not as much happening. And so you get this, you know, widening and shortening kind of process throughout. And I think that really helps in terms of kind of pacing. And when I love them, that, you know, everyone likes these different kind of writing maxims. But two I really like is this idea of arriving late and leaving early. I think that's a screenwriting maxim, but I think it's a really useful one when you're editing as well. You know, are you sort of writing yourself into a scene and it's taking a bit long to get going? Are you in a scene, you know, the dramatic moment has finished and you're kind of dribbling on, and can you just kind of finish more quickly? And usually, you know, there's ways you can do both of those. And I think going back to the concertina process, I think Lee Child said this, but it's this idea of writing the fast stuff slow and the slow stuff fast. So when you've got, you know, a fast moment, you know, give that to the reader in its, you know, in its full detail. And if you've got a slow moment, then whiz on past the next one. And I think if you can have all that in the back of your mind as you're editing, that will certainly help to shape your novel in a really good way.
Yeah. And then at what point do I give you a ring and say, right, I need some professional help?
I think it varies from script to script. So there are, I mean, sometimes people ask me whether they need their manuscript edited before they send it to an agent or a publisher. And I don't think they do, because any decent agent or publisher is going to come back with changes. So if you've paid money to have it edited and then you go back and rewrite it, that editing is wasted. I think there's organizations like the Literary Consultancy or Cornerstones who do good, you know, manuscript overviews and assessment of the shape of the book. And I think before you submit, that might be something to consider. Sometimes you can get that from those kind of organisations. Sometimes if you've got a good group of writers who you work with, who you share your script with, from that sort of wisdom of crowd, you can get a lot of that information that way around as well. So I would say probably, although I'm probably talking myself out of a job here, is that you're only really go to those organizations when you're stuck. If you've got a script and you just can't see how to push it forwards, you need someone to unblock it, I would say that's usually the point to go to those manuscripts. I mean, the stuff I do for the Literary Consultancy, for example, usually the scripts come with a covering letter or someone saying, I don't know, I've sent it out to 10 agents, they've all rejected it. You know, can you tell me why? So it's more that part of the chain, but I think quite often if you've got a good group of writers who you share work with, you know, they will pick up the general points.
Well, we have a good group of writers we work with, don't we?
We do. We get very good feedback, you know, helpful feedback, not always positive. That's the main thing.
Yeah.
I was wondering, Tom, if you approach fiction and non-fiction differently as an editor, is there any difference?
That's a good question. Yes and no. And actually, I think, because a lot of the non-fiction I do, so with the ghostwriting, I'm writing kind of memoir generally. It tends to be kind of biographies of different people. So actually there, you're using a lot of the skills that you use for fiction, whether it's terms of thinking about narrative structure, whether it's thinking about, like, I suppose, kind of character development and how they've grown and and change as individuals. So no, a lot of it's quite similar actually, and I think there is that overlap these days between the two. And actually, you know, the number of nonfiction books I've read recently. I mean, I read one which is a political book over Christmas, and in the blurb it said, you know, this book reads like a thriller. Yeah. And I think more and more that those techniques have kind of come in, and probably there's the flip side as well. In that there's that element of realism, perhaps, in fiction sometimes, and that's where that kind of borrows there. But no, it's, you know, it all comes down to the same basic elements, which is, you know, story and narrative and getting the readers to turn the page. And that doesn't matter whether it's, you know, narrative nonfiction or narrative fiction. It's the same kind of pull.
Okay, thank you.
That's excellent. Have you got any questions, Nicola?
Well, only to say, do you have any tips for someone who every time they edit, they add more stuff in, only to find that later on they said exactly the same thing in a different part of the story? It's, I find editing is adding rather than taking away.
I have a friend.
Yeah, ask him for a friend.
Yeah, well, I think when you read back through, hopefully you can spot some of that stuff. And I think sometimes it's having space. So when I finish a script, I tend to try and leave it alone for a month or 6 weeks, and then you can read back through and you can spot those kind of points where you've repeated yourself.
Yeah.
Mm. And I think
and the continuity errors with people that have died before they've got sick and stuff like that. Hey,
well, there's always stuff, like when you move stuff around, there's always stuff like that kind of happening. But I think also you can get repeats of words and phrases as well. I mean, that's very easy to do, to find that you're using the same kind of bits of body language, or there's particular words you use, and you can do a kind of search all and just see.
There is a tool on the Writers and Artists website which allows you to count phrases and words in manuscripts. Yeah. So we'll post the link to that on the Facebook group after it goes out. Okay, Tom, thank you very much indeed.
Well, that was just brilliant, wasn't it? And I'm sure we've all learned a lot. So tell us your experiences of editing so far, everyone.
I think I need to not go back and edit, but plough on. This is my problem. I write something and then I go over it, and then I look at it again and think, oh, that could be better and that could be better. And I think I need to learn from other people and just plough on and do the editing later. I mean, I think it's okay to look back at what you did yesterday a little bit, but then you've got to keep moving on. I think that's my problem. But in terms of actually editing, you know, in the sense that Tom's talking about, I'm not there yet. I haven't got a complete manuscript of the novel. So
I've got a strong belief that it's different parts of your brain. So working, I believe in batching your time so that you're in, and if you're doing one, I mean, for example, I always do my accounts and admin on a different day to the days where I'm writing newsletters, for example, because I just feel that your brain gets into a flow state when you just keep doing the same kind of activity for a day, as we've talked about before. So
That
could be the issue. You're using a right brain, left brain.
I need to, you know, I can take a lot of advice from you, Nicola. It's going to be a great influence on us.
Well, it's just, you know, effective ways to work. Yeah. Steph, what about you? How do you get on with editing?
I sometimes feel that I'm fraying my work as well as fraying at the edges because I'm going over and over it. But obviously Tom's given us some good tips. And I think one of the things for me will be when I go and get a professional editor involved and stop trying to do it myself. Mm. So when that time will come, I don't know. Mm. But I know where I'll be going.
my other podcast partner, Judith, just published a book, and she said she's actually had two or three different kinds of editors. She's had one just to read and look for grammar and spelling and things like that.
That's going to do my punctuation.
And then the proofreading one.
And then there's one person who's looking for things like, you know, they have in movies where continuity errors and things like that. And then she had one person right at the very end who she knows is deeply pedantic. And so they read last so that they would. She knew that anything that slipped through the other two would not get past that one.
I did it like you, I think. I tend to sort of try and just move on, but then if I leave a gap, I think, well, I'll just go back to sort of get back into the flow. Mm. And then I'll think, maybe, and like you, I then
start adding bits and start wondering about, well, should I put that there or shall I leave that and put it somewhere else? A kind of a mishmash, really.
Mm. Do you ever kind of look at a word and think, I'm sure there's a better word than that?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Because it's interesting, when we spoke to Catherine de Bono a few weeks ago, and she said that when she's not sure of something, she writes in capitals. Mm-hmm. And I know you need the space, don't you? Mm-hmm. You don't know what the word
sometimes,
is.
Yeah.
But I'm going to start doing that, because it's easy to find where, you, as you're writing, where you think, that's not really the right word, but I'll just put this word in, put it in caps, and I can find it.
I sometimes add a comment, you know, because I'm posting out a comment and say, you know, this can be better.
I tend to do the wrong thing, probably, because when I come to that point and I need a word, I go to the synonym finder and start looking for a better word. Well, it's just that I shouldn't be doing that on the right time. I think it would be better if I did, you know, what you did.
It can divert you, so you end up going off.
Just put it in bold or italics or something to go back to.
Well, you end up going and finding out all about Lieber Kubler's Ballycumbers, which is what to me, which, as it turned out, was okay, but it did kind of, it was a bit of a trail through some words.
Sorry, I was just going to say, Bill, so I, because you're all talking about typing and silence, I write longhand to start with, and then I'll type it up. Mm. And so I do some editing as I'm typing as well.
I would install Grammarly on my and it's driving me absolutely bonkers. If anything more is more guaranteed to stop you in your flow, I've never come across it. It's the most irritating thing.
Because it goes around underlining these things.
Underlining it, and it puts these flash-up little screens in front of everything, so you can't, oh my God, it's driving me crazy. And I can't work out how to uninstall it now, either.
Well, if you can't do it, Nicola,
who cares? No, there's no
hope. Oh, I've had a very difficult technological week this week. What are the semicolons of my computer playing tunes at me? Oh, dear.
Well, you know what I have discovered, and everybody knew this at age 10 except me, but, and you've always heard people say, oh, well, I'll sleep on it and get back to you or something. And it's been surprising to me, but we were away at Christmas time and I had jet lag, etc. I came home and was sleeping earlier in the evening and getting up earlier in the mornings. And I found that I was going to bed with, you know, some dilemma on my mind, having to do with my writing. And when I woke up in the morning, first thoughts, and it was there untangled.
Wow.
You know? And
that's
I thought,
your subconscious at work.
Isn't it wonderful that you just give it a rest and it will work it out by itself, Linda? Don't keep worrying it.
Or have you been writing so much that, though, isn't it? Don't you think it's that a lot? Don't you think a lot of it is about, it's all whirring around at the back of your head and occasionally the thoughts pop
forward? You've got to take your eye off the ball, haven't you? And I mean, I think you've said before, Stephanie, about going for a walk. And of course, walking is great for sorting your thoughts out, but letting it come, letting it flow.
This happened to me twice this week. Wow. And both times it was very productive.
Brilliant.
And so I'm thinking, okay, I'm just going to go to bed whenever a problem
brings. It's called hibernation, isn't it?
Waking
up when it's over.
Yeah. The interesting thing about all of this is it's got a name now. It's neuroscience.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of the things that, you know, creative people have known throughout the years, you know, the best habits of creative people or people who've got, you know, locked themselves away in follies or, you know, the Moleskine diary being used, you know, from the turn of the last century onwards and things like that. It's all of these hacks, creativity hacks, have been known for hundreds of years. It's only now they're starting to actually put the science to it as well. So it's a well-known phenomenon that go to bed with a, and think of your challenge, and often you wake up in the morning and your subconscious has been at it.
Yeah, I just thought that was so wonderful. I did not know that I had such a friend up here in my brain.
But you told us he was a little man with a jackhammer.
Oh, no, that's the ego.
That's right, the other
guy. That's the ego. Yeah.
He's in there, right, that evil editor with the jackhammer.
Yeah, ego. And but the subconscious is your friend, and you'll never get to know the subconscious. They never pop up. It's all seething away beneath the surface.
Well, I was just thinking if perhaps instead of getting to a point where the jackhammer guy comes in, if I just say, okay, take a nap, it will be handled in a kinder, gentler way.
It's close the door and done at the door.
Right.
Again, I'm always creative places like Google. They have nap rooms for people.
Who
want to go and have a Google, the big Googleplex in California. They have nap rooms and things.
Well, I've got a nap room. It's called my bedroom.
Right, so let's move on. Talking of sleeping, it's time to find out what's on our bedside table. So, Pat, we'll go over to you and find out what you're reading at the moment.
Okay. Rediscovery, really. It's The Uncommon Reader by Alan Bennett. And it's one of those things I'm thinking, have I read this before? Every now and again I come across a bit of it. I'm sure I've read this, but then other parts not. I don't. It is only a short novel, and the reader in question is the Queen, Her Madge. And it starts when she discovers a travelling library in the grounds of the palace one day. She's chasing after the corgis, and she feels that she ought to borrow a book.
Show willing.
And she starts to read, which is something she's never really done before. And she's helped by Norman, who was the only other customer in the travelling library, and he's actually a kitchen hand, works in the kitchens. Also gay, but not outrageously so, but does have a preference for gay literature. But he's well-read and quite intelligent, and whenever she goes two or three times to start with, he's always there, and she looks to him for advice on what to read. So they develop this relationship. And eventually she becomes really quite addicted to reading. She has Norman, that's it, yeah. She has him promoted and has him stationed outside her room and sends him off to get books for her. And because she's obviously the patron of major library in London, she sends him off there and he's absolutely amazed by this place. It's just quite nice, the relationship between them. Because of the reading, she starts to see things in a very different way. According to the blurb on Amazon, the consequences, of course, surprising, mildly shocking, and very funny. Mm-hmm. And it is, that's the whole good. Thing is funny.
Excellent.
In that sort of very dry way that's typical of Alan
Bennett. Yeah. I take it this isn't a true story.
I bet she's read it. Yeah, I bet she's read it and had a right good laugh.
Marvellous.
A lot of the humour comes from his characterisation of it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the television show that was on recently about the old lady who lived in his drive. That was just fantastic. I really enjoyed it, but I thought the DVD.
Would you tell me again the author's name?
Alan Bennett.
Thank you.
Very British.
Oh,
you'll love it.
Yeah. And very fun.
I'm afraid it's far too late to enter, but next week we'll be announcing our competition winners. So please join us for that show. We're looking forward to sharing the winner with you. That's the end of the show now. Say goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.